This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to visit with Lee Kaiser in Julesburg, Colorado. It's a town of a little less than 1,500 people up in the northeastern corner of the state that pokes a dent up into Nebraska. If you're ever taking a cross-country trip on Interstate 80, Lee's Old Ford Garage and Museum is just a quick detour that will be well worth your while. We'll talk a little more about that before we're done, but we left off with the 18-year-old having graduated high school here in Julesburg in abbreviated fashion, joining the Navy, and deploying as a signalman on the USS Wilson, a destroyer that eventually would be subjected to atomic bomb tests after World War II at Bikini Atoll. But a year before that, in 1945, the Wilson experienced some intense action in the Pacific. So explain it to us, Lee. When general quarters would sound on your destroyer, what would you have to do?
I was on the bridge as a lookout. Or if I wasn't doing that, I'd be copying the signals that the signalman was taking. Every signalman had to have a writer. I did a lot of that.
And maybe this is a dumb question, but did it occur to you at that point or any other point that your life was in danger, that you might not ever make it back here to Julesburg?
Constantly. My whole time in the Navy, long as the war was on, and we never got out of the combat zone. We were exposed all the time.
Well, and that was kind of the whole function of your ship, wasn't it? Yeah. To take the hits for the big ships.
We were the escorts and the scouts of the big ships, and we were supposed to shoot down and sink every submarine to make sure they didn't hit the big ships.
And you mentioned the advent of those suicide attacks and the kamikazes. What's the first memory you have of that, of either hearing about it or seeing it actually take place?
In the Philippines was where we first exposed to the suicide planes. I saw several ships get hit before the suicide plane dove into the hold of the ammunition ship. And then, of course, that was something you never will forget.
So when you see that, when you hear about that, when you realize that's part of the reality, I imagine there's part of you that says, hey, that could happen to our ship, and what's going to happen if it does?
Well, we were always prepared. We always had our life jackets on. We always had our helmets on for safety. They didn't have to tell you to do it because you knew we were going to be in combat and something was going to happen. Of course, along with that, the destroyers were also assigned to ships that had been hit. And we went alongside a lot of ships that was burning and a lot of casualties laying on the decks of the ships. And then we didn't know what their cargo was, their manifest. Are you carrying aviation gasoline? So yes, we are. Or other war materials. And they would sometime be on fire, and several of them we couldn't save. But we could save what crew hadn't been killed.
That had to be hard to watch, hard to witness, hard to see guys just like you who are in that kind of condition.
That's very hard to see, very hard to watch. I'd still get calls from the East Coast from fathers who had been rescued by the Wilson. Their kids called me up once in a while and said, my dad thanks you again for saving his life. And that's just a small example of many, many stories.
Well, and you mentioned something that I don't want to let it get away without following up a little bit. When I was asking you about high school and all your athletic exploits, you mentioned the swimming while you're on the Wilson, that if you guys went to rescue a downed pilot, you were supposed to swim out and help him to the ship?
We put a belt around us with two hooks on it, with two lines. We swim out there and try to get the pilot out of the cockpit and so forth. It only had to happen a couple of times because we took turns doing it. And if we could get them out and save them, get them aboard ship, we'd do best to save them.
So you actually personally were able to do that a couple times?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm imagining those pilots had to be pretty happy to see you.
Well, some of them were wounded. Some were shot down because they were, a couple of them, I wasn't on that detail. One of them couldn't get out. They couldn't unfasten his safety belts, and the plane was beginning to tip, and they lost him. He was that close to being saved.
Again, I don't know what it feels like, but it sounds probably nerve-wracking. You really are in a race against time when you're doing that.
Well, you can't say that you ever get used to it, but you get immune to it after a while. After you see so many casualties in war, lots of different things happen in war.
So it's one thing to get out to the plane with all that, and then you got to get the pilot out, and then you got to get him back to the ship. Was that difficult to get him back there with you?
Well, not necessarily. We'd get him aboard our whale boat. We'd get him back to their ship as soon as we possibly could. or we'd keep them until it was we'd be in a safer area, because you were always possible to be attacked any time.
Well, and that's what I was thinking when you're talking about escorting damaged ships and wondering what's inside of them. You're wondering because they're going really slow. They're a pretty easy target, a sitting duck, and by virtue of that, you guys are too. That had to be kind of scary.
Well, we had pretty good speed. We could do 38 knots, which is about 45 miles an hour, but we could also slow up real fast too, pull right up alongside and right quick. But we wouldn't stay too long in the water one spot for fear of submarines. Nothing would be easier for a submarine to hit a dead ship.
Did you have any scares with subs?
Oh, yeah. A lot of scares. We had great sound equipment, and we could detect subs for quite a ways. And I think we got credit for sinking three.
Dropping depth charges on them?
Yeah.
And anything that I don't touch on that you want to share, please do. But you mentioned Iwo Jima, and I'm thinking about what you said your duty station was as a lookout on the bridge. And I'm thinking about Iwo Jima. You guys, I'm sure, were firing some shells that way. But did you end up seeing the flag go up on Suribachi from where you were?
I saw the second flag that went up.
The one that everybody else has seen. A lot of people don't even know about the first one.
That's when I saw the second one. Because we were on the second day, we brought in the reserves for the landing. And the flag had already been raised, but I did see the second one.
Well, and what was that like? Because that image was so powerful here, back home, for people to see that Rosenthal photo of the Marines lifting it, even though that individual act had very little to do with the battle that unfolded there. There was such symbolic value in it for a lot of people here. What about for you, out there in the middle of the ocean, so far away from home, to see that Stars and Stripes on the high ground of Iwo Jima?
Well, of course, I was on the bridge and had a long glass, 32-power long glass, and it was easy for me to see it. But actually, our duty was to fire star shells all night long to light up Iwo Jima, so the Marines had a chance to see what was happening. And we stayed there for, probably almost 3 weeks. And then we had to restock our star shells.
You were the lighting department?
Yeah. Right, you might say.
So, and I don't want to, put words in your mouth, but was it significant to see that flag flying up there on Suribachi? Did it mean anything to you?
Not necessarily, because I knew it wasn't the first one. I just thought it was in the morning, and they were just raising the colors again. But come to find out that it was the reenaction of it.
And the most famous photo of all time, probably. Well, what else? I want to ask you about the day your ship was hit with the kamikaze, but I'm sure there are other things that happened throughout your time in the Pacific that stand out for you that were significant, whether it's a close call or something that you were proud of that you or your ship were able to do?
April 16th at 9:30 in the morning, we were sitting off of Okinawa a ways, waiting for, we called the cap, waiting for the suicide planes to come in. And then to the south of us, here come a low-flying plane, and our captain said he's heading for us. And as he approached, he said he's going to get us. And he did. He hit us. He was carrying a 500-pound bomb. He released the bomb before he got to the ship. The bomb went through the skin of the ship, but did not explode. But the rest of the plane went over the fantail of the ship, and scraped it with all the guys on the back of the ship.
And you're telling me what the captain's saying, and I want to make sure I understand. You're with him there on the bridge, and you're hearing him saying it, like from me to you?
Yes, real close.
And could you see it too?
Oh yes, I saw it coming in. But I had the phones on, my helmet on, and the phones was connected to the cord. The whole ship was communicated with each other anytime. And so the captain said, "We got to get out of here." So I was the first one around the corner of the bridge. I come to the end of the cord, fell on my back, and the rest of the crew fell on, the captain fell on top of me, and pushed in the speaker in my mouth and on my nose. I lost all my teeth of it. But they didn't fall out, and they said, "Anybody hurt?" And I was just a young 18-year-old kid, and I didn't report it. No, I'm all right. But later on, the Navy put in some teeth for me.
So how many teeth did it knock out?
All my bottom teeth and several of my upper teeth. Some of them didn't fall out until after I got home.
Did break your nose too?
Yeah.
And this is all trying to get out of there and try to help wherever help's needed. But what were you able to do after sustaining that injury?
Well, there's always a little bit of humor, whatever it happens. And I was laying on my back looking up, and the captain was on his stomach looking down right face to face. And he says, "Sailor, get to your post right now or I'll court-martial you. And I said, Captain, just as soon as you get off the top of me, I will.
And it's good to have humor. You need it in those situations, but I'm sure it wasn't long till you realized some of your shipmates had been killed.
Right. We found that out later. Now, here was an event that was kind of sad. The men in the magazine were trapped, and the chief come up to the captain and says, the magazine's smoking, Captain, and we don't know whether it's on fire, but if it's on fire and in the magazine, she's going to blow. And the captain says, well, what do you recommend, flood the magazine or take a chance she won't blow? Chief said, I'm not making that decision. You'll have to make it. So the captain said, then flood the magazine, meaning that if they weren't dead, that they drowned. And he said, now don't ever tell me how they died. He was a captain from the Great Lakes area out of Chicago, and he was a very good captain.
Can you imagine having that decision rest on your shoulders, having to make that life or death call about those sailors?
I thought about that my whole life and still do. But I imagine a lot of commanders in World War II had to make similar type of decisions.
And I think I read there were 5 men who died that day?
Right.
Were they all in the magazine?
Yeah, and that's where I was supposed to be, because everybody changes places ever so often to become efficient in case you do get hit. No matter where you are, you're supposed to be well trained for wherever you are. And those were all my shipmates and buddies that got killed.
And what do you mean you were supposed to be there? Your shift was about to change or what?
Well, no. Some of the guys are on the bridge and some of the guys on general quarters. We change back and forth so that we become sufficient in no matter where we are aboard ship that we can fill in. And it just so happened that I was on the bridge at that time.
And I know this is redundant for you or obvious, but for folks listening, I know they're reading between the lines, but let's spell it out really clearly. Your captain in that moment had to decide whether to definitely sacrifice those 5 lives or their lone chance of saving those lives was risking the rest of the ship, right? I mean, what would have happened if that magazine blew up?
The ship would have went down, especially with that 500-pound bomb and the magazine, probably in 30 seconds. She would have broke right into and sank. There probably would have been, if any, very few survivors out of the 300 guys aboard ship. Captain Roberts was the captain at that time, and he was a very, very good captain, very considerate to everybody.
And if you had been in that magazine, like you easily could have, you certainly would have wanted him to save your life. But the decision he made likely did save your life, right?
That's right. He saved mine because I wasn't in that magazine.
Well, and if he didn't flood it and it exploded, you would have been out of luck.
Yeah, that's right.
And you mentioned the 500-pound bomb that didn't explode. Where did that bomb end up?
In the communication compartment where all the signalmen and the radiomen were. A demolition squad came aboard from one of the big tenders and disarmed the bomb. Then they gradually pushed it out the same hole that it went through the skin of the ship, which with the back end was underwater, and then shoved it out into the ocean. Then the crews come in and they welded the plate where the bomb went through. Then we pumped all the water out of the back end of the ship and went right back into action again.
Well, I asked you about the magazine, if it had exploded. What about that bomb? If that 500-pound bomb had gone off, what would have happened to you?
Being on the bridge, it would have buckled and I would have went down with the ship without a question.
If it had gone off, the old Ford garage and museum and its upstairs annex that tells stories more like what we're hearing today would have never come into existence. And I'll tell you, this is one episode where checking out the photos and videos online are going to add a lot more to what you're hearing from Lee Kaiser. So I hope you'll go to hometownheroesradio.com or pull up the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. When we come back, the specific duty Lee's ship had during the signing of the surrender in Tokyo Bay in September 1945. And the gruesome assignment he had to carry out right after that. We'll hear the rest of Navy veteran Lee Kaiser's story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU CCU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight.
Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials for free
because of the leadership and financial support of EECU.
Ready to join the team yet?
Call 1-800-538-3328.